Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It is January 8th. I'm going to stop doing this. I'm going to stop naming the date. It's just that it is 8 days into the decade, and it's not letting up. So we asked Tim Miller to come into our new studios in Washington, D.C. So this will be the first podcast from our new studios. Tim, thanks for coming in.
It's looking so fancy here, Charlie. We're out of a broom closet. We have a very small window now. It's a big upgrade, and I'm happy to be here with you.
I like the broom closet. And of course, I'm sitting in Wisconsin, in where we have no snow, we have no slush. You do have snow and slush there, but you made it in, which is an indication of how intrepid you are, especially considering the fact that you're a Californian.
But I grew up in Colorado, Charlie, so I can brave the elements. I don't think it says anything about my character that I can do it, but I am capable. I don't like it, though. Okay. It's very strange. I couldn't find my winter coat. Being in California is much more pleasant, but that's, I guess, for another pod.
Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned the word character, and I am admitting that I'm getting exhausted with the question of, like, what has happened to Republicans, or when are Republicans ever going to stand up? Because the answer, at least to the second one, is never. I mean, we've done this, right? I mean, we're through all of this, but still, let's talk about Nikki Haley for a moment. Nikki Haley, who was one of the very few people who left the Trump administration with their reputation intact. Would you agree with me on this?
Feel free to I mean, quasi-intact. Intact. I agree with the premise.
Quasi-intact, right, which is the best you can hope for.
Right.
And she has been on this I Really Am a Trumpist tour since then, and really kind of outdid herself the other day. And she goes on, is this CNN or Fox? I'm not sure.
CNN.
And she's attacking the Democrats for their position. Well, let's just play the soundbite. Here's Nikki Haley.
You don't see anyone standing up for Iran. You're not hearing any of the Gulf members. You're not hearing China. You're not hearing Russia. The only ones that are mourning the loss of Soleimani are our Democrat leadership and our Democrat presidential candidates. No one else in the world, because they knew that this man had evil veins. They knew what he was capable of, and they saw the destruction and the lives lost based from his hands.
Okay. So, Tim, what is with Nikki Haley? I mean, you remember when Nikki Haley used to give speeches about civility? You remember when she was the governor of South Carolina and she was kind of the moral force behind taking down the Confederate flag, when she said basically anybody but Trump, that Trump was the worst nightmare that any governor would have? And here she is, in a sense, saying, no, I'm like this female Charlie Kirk.
I do remember this. Why this one is a particularly hard one for me. I mean, there have been so many hard ones, as you know better than anybody, coming out of Wisconsin, having everyone disappoint you one at a time. But I consulted for Nikki on her reelect. I don't want to pretend like I was particularly close to her or anything, but I was involved with her reelect campaign, and really did like her, and kind of even. She was like one of my few exceptions to going into the Trump administration, where I sort of understood, the decision making, and I thought that she kind of walked that tightrope of distancing where necessary. I mean, it's not the choice I would have made, but I guess maybe because of my internal blinders, I like was hoping that Nikki would be, the potential savior. It's mind-boggling. I mean, you said Charlie Kirk's name, and you alluded to her old speeches about civility. I pulled up. She gave a really wonderful speech that makes me wonder who actually wrote it. I've been thought about texting, like, to see who wrote this speech, because obviously they weren't her words, about the problem with owning the libsism. Right, and she spoke.
Oh yes, that's right. That was after she left too. Yeah,
yeah, it was after she left, and she spoke to a group of college Republicans at my alma mater, GW, and she said basically, that I know it's fun. Here, I'm looking at it now. I know that it's fun. It can feel good, but step back and think about what you're accomplishing when you do this. Are you persuading anyone? Who are you persuading? It wasn't a full sister soldier moment, I guess, but it felt like it was, somebody standing up and saying, there are adults in the room here, and we cannot just completely devolve down this Trumpist hole. And now she's been on this tour where it might as well be called the Owning the Libs tour. And her comments, that you just played about how about Democrats, you know, we're mourning Soleimani. You know, it's just, it is the lowest of the, it's what you'd expect from like Judge Jeanine, you know? I mean, it is even below, you know, how far like the Rubios and Cruises go sometimes. You know?
Oh, the fact that you threw in Rubio there. Okay. And, you know, and part of it's a little bit of this, you know, I suppose I have a little thing about the, this, you know, the our Democrat leadership and Democrat presidential candidates. That's kind of that whistle out there, you know, not calling them Democratic candidates or Democratic
now,
leaders.
Can I interject?
It's sort of like I am one of you, Redneck Nation.
Yeah, I used to, and so as as somebody who's guilty of this, I used to do this when I was an RNC Rapid Response Director, and I enjoyed. I basically did it because I enjoyed how much it needled the left, right? But you know, and so,
so you were into owning the libs at one time.
I was.
So you
I
know
was.
This.
Yes, I was. Mm-hmm. So I admit that, and I'm gonna just, you know, kind of chastise myself here, and you can't see it, but I'm whipping myself on the back in the office for my past crimes. But you know, even then, it felt childish. But it was kind of like I was the attack dog at the RNC. It felt like that was my job to needle them and to be childish, right? You know, I mean, like, even at the time, it was something that I wouldn't, when I was writing speeches for candidates, I wouldn't put that in there, right? You know, I mean, it felt like, so, you know, this is not to excuse my behavior, but it's just to say that I recognize the impulse, but if you are trying to position yourself as a former UN ambassador, as a future, you know, somebody to pass the baton over to, as a future world leader, like, why do this, right? Like, why, what is the point of this unnecessary owning the libs, like, you know, screw by calling them, you know, by saying that the Democrat leaders were mourning the death of this terrorist? I mean, it's just, it literally is, you know, like what you'd expect from
well,
Pete
decline,
Hegseth.
Yeah, decline is a choice. Dumbing down is a choice. So I had forgotten about that whole speech that she gave, because that really was, that was one of those moments where and those of us who are, you know, Trump skeptical, contrarian, conservative, we grab onto any flicker of hope. And that was a little bit of a flicker of
hope.
A
little bit of water in the desert. It was an oasis, the disappearing oasis.
Yeah.
We thought we could take
a
drink.
It was a mirage.
Yeah.
So Nikki,
no,
it
and I remember
like
that.
She's deciding who she wants to be when she grows up. Does she want to be the conscience of the party? Does she want to be the voice of decent conservatives? And apparently, she decided, I'm going to go all in on this.
To me, honestly, what I think it shows is, you know, the Trump era has reveals about people, and that's the one thing that maybe not the only thing, but one of the benefits of the last 4 years is that. I do think it's been very revealing about people's true nature, and this is a great example of that. I think that Nikki, you know, had some, you know, good advice, some good consultants who thought that maybe she could leave this administration and triangulate, and figure out a way to be a bridge. And this speech was a way for her to signal that. But then, you know, she goes on a media tour. And, you know, you get sucked into wanting to get the applause and the accolades and the cheers. And this is what does it. You know, this is what the people are looking for. She's giving the people what they want. And it's that, you know, kind of same internal need to be validated that you see from the Lindsey Grahams of the world are showing themselves in Haley. I mean, the other thing that she said the other day, which I thought was like the least self-aware thing in the world, and I wish I had the exact quote in front of me, but she sent a tweet about, you know, how it's the heroes are the people who stand up against the mob, right? And she was like saying that to the Republicans. It's like that the media is the mob and that we're the ones standing up to them. And it's just like, Nikki, I don't think that you really, I think you should have given that one a couple more reads before you sent it out.
Sort of like Mad Libs of cliches that no longer apply. Okay, so speaking of which, since we're into the, you know, confessional stage, there was a time when I would have described myself as a Marco Rubio Republican. Okay, pause for me to cringe here a little bit. That
I had to beat on
Time
that one.
Magazine said, remember when they featured him that he was the Republican savior?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember.
I believe that shit for a while. Now I know you're like a Jeb exclamation point guy, but bear with me. I really did think that this guy represented the future of the party, and you know, you watch how everyone is shrinking. It's like you dive into that Trump swamp, and it must be very, very cold because there's a lot of shrinkage. And here you have Marco Rubio asked on CNN why he would vote against a subpoena of John Bolton, who, of course, you know, said, hey, I'm willing to actually testify and tell you guys what happened in case you're interested in all that. He says, I think in my view, our inquiry should be based on the testimony that they took. We are acting on the articles of impeachment. We should be constrained by the information those articles are based on.
Where did he come up with that?
He's just making that up. But yeah. Here you have Marco Rubio, of all the members of the Senate, jumping out and saying, "Yeah, I'm going to vote against letting having the American public and my colleagues hear John Bolton with his firsthand information about this this episode."
Yeah, so there, I mean, there are two. Yeah, there are two issues. One, where does he even come up with that? But two, because he has this reputation, which is wrong, I think, among his colleagues, of not being, you know, not having gone full Trump. The negative side of this is that he's kind of giving an excuse to the Murkowskis of the world, and, you know, the other Lamar Alexanders, the people that you might think would potentially align with Romney and try to push McConnell into having some real witnesses and having a real trial here. He's creating this insane excuse out of whole cloth that has no basis in any legal or historical precedent. And he's given these guys cover, whether he intends to do it or not, I don't know. And so I, going back to your point on being full Marco, my confession here is, for if there are any Jeb people listening, that I always had a secret soft spot for Marco. It seemed like my colleagues were the right ones. They a lot of them had distaste for Marco, but I really didn't have the loathing of him. That's sort of the rivalry, you know, never really manifested in me. And so I, you know, got though the disappointment early, which was after Jeb dropped out, you know, I supported an anti-Trump PAC. And if everybody remembers, you know, Marco takes a lot of crap over the, you know, the hand joke debate. But I actually thought the real revealing part of that showed what the Marco was to come was, after the pushback against that, in the next debate, right before the Florida primary, you know, Marco basically had two options. He could have dropped out and supported Ted, who was going against him, you know, or he could have gone ham on Trump one more time and just said, I'm going to the mat on this. But the final debate before the Florida primary, he basically completely walked back, you know, his whole strategy that he had executed before of attacking Trump and demeaning him because of the negative pushback. And so you saw then, it just, he didn't, he is not the person that you're going to look to that is, you know, going to stand athwart anything. I kind of at that point knew that, that was the real Marco. And time again, we've continued to see that. I always go back to my favorite Marco quote is right before the election. He said his final ad to voters was, I'm the only person in this race that will stand up to either President Trump or Clinton if they win. It's like, oh yeah, really followed through on that campaign promise, Marco.
Oh yeah, no, I remember that. I'm trying to find this quote about Lindsey Graham from
Schmidt.
Is it in this role? Yeah, Schmidt, where he basically says, in order to understand, you probably saw this, in order to understand Lindsey Graham, you have to understand that he's sort of the like the pilot fish, the little fish that always lines up behind somebody.
There's a great Schmidt.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, and he talks about how he survives off the detritus of the of the anchor fish. Yes, I do know what you're talking about. I read it, and it was exactly right. And basically, the Schmidt's point is that, like, when McCain, was do you have it?
Yeah. Let me just read it here. People try to analyze Lindsey through the prism of the manifest inconsistencies that exist between things he used to believe and what he's doing now, Schmidt says. The way to understand him is to look at what's consistent. And essentially, what he is in American politics is what in the aquatic world would be a pilot fish, a smaller fish that hovers around a larger predator, like a shark living off of its, how do you pronounce it, detritus?
I don't know.
That's Lindsey. And when he swam around the McCain shark, broadly viewed as a virtuous and good shark, Lindsey took on the patina of virtue. But wherever the apex shark is, you find the Lindsey fish hovering about. And Trump's the newest shark in the sea. Lindsey has a real draw to power, but he's found it unattainable on his own merits. That is devastating, and it's devastating because it sounds so real.
Yeah, and the last sentence is where it's at. I mean, Schmidt gets points from the Russian judge for style on Derritus or whatever it was. That's so good. But the last point is where it's at. Is that it's this attraction to power. And I, whenever anybody who's outside of politics kind of asks me to explain this to them, you know, what I say less colorfully than Steve is that people who get into this business, politics, like. What their drug is they want to be in the room. They want to feel important. It's less about doing good things for most of them. Some of them want to do good things, but it's about feeling important and being important. It's not about money. You know, it's not like the Wall Street guys. Like, their drug is being in the room and being able to, you know, leave the room and say to people that they know that they're the ones that are in the know. That's Lindsay, right? That is Lindsay. And so... You know, I truly believe that if President AOC, you know, becomes president in 2028, that Lindsay will suck up to her and try to convince her that, you know, she should engage in a bombing of some whatever, you know, country he's focused on at that time. And that is that is really, you know, the one area where I guess I don't know if you'd call it principled, but where there is some consistency with Lindsay and
he likes
Steve
bombing people.
Yeah, well, and he wants to have influence over the bombing of people, I guess, actually, more than that, more than the bombing itself. He wants to feel like he is part of the conversation. And Trump has allowed him to do that just like McCain did. And so he's going to ride it out.
OK, speaking of that, now try to be a Trump world whisperer here and explain this to me, okay? We're in the middle of Trump world, right? So two questions. Do we believe the deep state or do we not believe the deep state? Do we trust the intelligence agencies or do we distrust the intelligence agencies? Go.
They believe that the deep state is out to get the president. I guess what I would say is if I was putting on my red hat, I would say that our view is that we believe that the deep state is out to get the president, but to the extent that they tell us something that we like, we're going to go with it. That's Trump. And that's Trump at his core.
Okay. Are we in favor of no endless wars, America first, or are we in favor of kicking Iran's ass?
Both.
How do you reconcile that?
Yeah.
How do you reconcile we are against endless wars, but we're not going anywhere, and if you mess with us, we're going to war?
Yeah, well, okay. It's the how you reconcile it is that the president wants to seem like a tough guy, but he doesn't want to go to war. And so he, you know, what he does is he is weak and we and has a, you know, big Twitter feed. And then eventually he gets pushed to an edge and he wants to scalp somebody. He's like, I'm not going to take you to war, but I'm going to do something really gross and depraved to the enemy. And that's how I'm going to demonstrate my toughness.
So the old was endless wars. The new is endless war crimes.
Yes.
I'm against war, but if you war fighters want to commit a war crime, I am right there behind you because I am the toughest son of a bitch on the block.
Yeah, and well, one of his key advisors, the Fox and Friends co-host Pete Hegseth, being pro war crime is his beat. Everybody has their hobby horses and pet issues. You know, I'm all about athlete pay, permanent daylight savings time, refugee resettlement. Pete Hegseth's beat, his hobby horse is pro war crime. We want to defend the guys that committed the war crimes and we want to commit more war crimes. And he's the key advisor to the president. I mean, as a Fox TV host, he's one of like the three or four key advisors that Trump actually cares about. And this is Trump. It's Trump's instinct is to be pro war crime also. And so, you know, that is how he demonstrates that he's tough while also sucking up to dictators and refusing to do the work necessary to, you know, support our, you know, men and women in the battlefield and actually coming up with a plan. He's not for any of that. You know, all he's for is, you know, whatever, bombing cultural sites and murdering the wives and babies of terrorists.
Okay, so televangelist Jim Baker.
Yeah.
Did you know he was still alive, by the way? I have no idea.
I saw the same thing on Twitter earlier today.
Okay.
I guess I hadn't really considered his alive status.
This is a test to see whether or not you are saved. So if you support bombing cultural sites and supporting war crimes, is that a sign that you have been saved by Jesus? I am sorry to be snarky, but I'm just trying to square all these circles here.
So one of my other hobby horses, Charlie, which is kind of similarly related to this, not about Baker per se, but is – And I just can't understand why these guys continue to get away with it. But if you follow this administration, part of the reason that they are able to, you know, square these circles, so to speak, is that the State Department, Pompeo in particular, but Tillerson was like this, Haley was like this when she was at the UN, they live in this fantasy world where the president is zombie Ronald Reagan. And that the United States is still for, you know, all mm-hmm. of the things that, that Republicans have been for historically. And then the president's policy is, you know, insane Donald Trump, you know, wild, sucking up to dictators here, killing dictators there, depending on, you know, who's staying at his hotels, right? And so then every once in a while, you know, the reality world has to meet, or the fantasy world has to meet the reality world. And as happened this week when Pompeo was asked about bombing cultural sites, and he's like, oh, we're not really doing that. That's just the president spouting off. Don't take that seriously. But the rest of the time, you know, they are able to kind of live in these two separate worlds. And in certain cases where, you know, in unhot areas of the world, it's actually true, right? Like there are certain parts of the world that Trump doesn't care about where the State Department is kind of acting like it would have acted under George H.W. Bush, right? Because there's just some diplomats who are, you know, out mm-hmm. there acting of their own accord. And Trump has been completely incompetent at putting his own people into a lot of these places. And so that is where you kind of see this disconnect the most strongly, and why, you know, and then the Trump voters can glom on to whichever side they like. You know, if you're a no endless wars Trumper, you know, you just listen to what Trump says. If you're a old establishment Republican who's gotten sucked up into all of this, you just say, well, no, listen to Pompeo.
Okay,
don't take it seriously.
Right. Well, I have another question.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and you already tweeted about this. So Rich Lowry, our friend from National Review, is tweeting about, you know, the Pentagon saying, no, we're not going to strike Iranian cultural sites, contradicting Trump. And he writes, Trump never should have talked about this, but it was also obvious that it was something that would never happen and wasn't even being considered. So are we supposed to take the president's comments seriously, literally, or neither?
Neither.
I'm confused.
Neither. Yeah. I mean, this is a prime example where Rich gets to live in this fantasy world where the, you know, the actual policy is what the deep state diplomats are executing in the Department of Defense and the Department of State, and we can just ignore what the president says. That was my tweet about this was, you know, the old line in the campaign was, you know, Trump voters took him seriously, but not literally. So anytime that, you know, CNN had their hair on fire about some quote, it was actually just a joke, or he wasn't really going to do that. I mean, he's not really going to ban all Muslims, right? And so now what Rich is saying is not only are we not supposed to take what he's saying literally, as they said in the campaign, but we shouldn't even take it seriously either. It's just the president letting off some steam. We obviously knew this was never going to happen. And, you know, to believe this, Charlie, you have to believe that there is literally zero value in the words of the president, and that the only yes. value exists in whatever is executed by the diplomats. And also there's zero value in letters that come from the Department of the Defense as well, unless they're actually signed by the president. But that is to believe that Trump's words don't matter. You have to believe that the president's words are meaningless. And I guess my final point on this is, like, to me, what you're getting is the worst of both worlds, if this is the case. You know, if it's that you're giving the Iranians the propaganda of the president of the United States saying that he's going to bomb their historic sites, but you're not actually backing it up with any military force or reality.
This strikes me as dangerous. That this is the moment that we've been talking about now for 3 years. That what happens when we get a international crisis in which the credibility of the United States government and the presidency actually matters, in which you need to rally support, in which people need to make intelligent decisions, in which we need to avoid miscommunication and miscalculations at all costs. And here we're at this moment, and even the president's supporters are basically saying, yeah, don't pay any attention to what the president is saying. It really is a remarkable moment, isn't it? Okay, so John Bolton. Is John Bolton ever going to testify in front of the Senate? This is a great parlor game.
This is
and if you want to go with this one, does John Bolton really want to testify in front of the Senate?
I hate giving John Bolton the credit, but it is kind of interesting, isn't it? Like in all this time where it's sort of the Trumpian Kremlinology has gotten pretty uninteresting because Trump is just such an obvious base figure that you kind of know, you know, what is motivating all his actions. The Bolton motivations are a huge question mark for me. I really don't know. I mean, on the one hand, there's reason to believe he was genuinely upset and concerned about what the president was doing in Ukraine with the Taliban and elsewhere. On the other hand, he's John Bolton. You know, he's going to need to sell books. He's got a crazy email list that I'm on, and I see some of the things that are being written on that he sends out on that, which aren't exactly kind of nuanced. Realist.
He wants to remain relevant.
Yeah, he wants
right?
to. Yes, and so, but unlike, you know, I guess there is a play. Though nobody's ever has used this play yet, which kind of surprised me. But there's a play to remain relevant, which is to do a face turn, right? To leave the. I guess Scaramucci's trying this, right? You kind of leave the White House and then, you know, you go suck up to all the anti-Trump people and see if they'll forgive you. There's that. But that's not what Bolton wants, right? Because Bolton actually does have core beliefs, right? Like he's a hawk at the core. So he's going to want the hawkish elements of the Republican base to you know, continue to buy his books, to continue to, you know, hire him as an advisor, you know, in future administrations. So like, I find it really hard to believe that somebody with those motivations is going to go to the Hill and absolutely, you know, shiv a president that is popular with the people that he wants approval from. So I have zero insight to offer our listeners on this one.
You actually did. That was very insightful. You got to give yourself some credit there. But what I think a lot of people outside of the right sphere don't fully understand is that it's not just that you might lose your job. You might, you know, lose your seat in the Senate or your seat in Congress. You become excommunicated from the entire conservative infrastructure. All of the groups that rely upon conservative donors, all of the think tanks, all of those folks that are on that email list, because John Bolton is not going to turn around and start singing Kumbaya with Elizabeth Warren and Howard Dean, you know, and folks like that. I mean, he is what he is. Donald Trump right now is pursuing a war that John Bolton really has been rooting for much of his life. Yeah. It's hard to imagine that he would blow himself up. But the calculation, and I said this yesterday on the podcast with David Priestin in my newsletter, best case scenario for him is to say, yeah, yes, I am absolutely willing to testify. Call Mitch McConnell's bluff. McConnell continues to obstruct it. And then he turns around and says, well, what I would have said, and he puts it in his best-selling blockbuster book. And then we'll see whether, you know, how that affects his ongoing relevance.
Yeah, maybe. I think that's definitely possible. It's also
he doesn't
possible,
want to be John Dean.
No, he certainly doesn't. And it's also possible that he testifies and, tries to walk the Michael Cohen line, you know, where, Cohen's testimony, the subject of his testimony, the content of it was pretty damning for the president, but his tone was defensive of him, you know, and so I think he kind of maintained a sort of line into that kind of Trumpian world when he gets out of the clink through that. And so it's possible that Bolton would go that route as well, which would just be, you know, kind of a little bit of a disappointment for all sides, maybe.
Okay, let's switch a little bit to Democratic politics. You had a very scary tweet the other day, pointing out that the smart set seems to be underestimating the possibility that Bernie Sanders could actually win the Democratic nomination. It's always been a relatively high possibility, but he's not being treated as somebody who is a front runner. He hasn't had the kind of scrutiny that Elizabeth Warren got recently. It's hard to imagine that Joe Biden would have been able to continue his campaign if he had had a heart attack. Mm-hmm. So Bernie has been living kind of a charmed life, and now we're looking around, we're looking over his shoulder, and he's surging in the polls in the early states, and he is raising way more money than anybody else. So where are we at here? Is this possible?
Are you getting any PTSD, Charlie? I have a little bit of PTSD, some deja vu of a,
how many months did we hear, don't worry, that will never happen. No, there's no way that will happen.
Yeah, I was at a meal with some friends the other day. This topic came up, and one of them said, Oh, well, he has a ceiling, though. I was like, I've heard that line before. I said that line a couple times in 2015, I think.
Voting hasn't even started yet.
Yeah, exactly. Or once we get down to two candidates, definitely Bernie can't get up to 50. It's concerning. And I do think that, the kind of media, I don't think that it's like a socialist bias towards Bernie. I really believe that there's a little bit of it during the campaign has been staleness about Bernie content. It was like, we did all this in 2016. You know, we've dumped the oppo. The stories have been written. That's part of it. And I think the other part is just an expectations game among the kind of center, and center left media. Has been that he wasn't going to be the nominee, and so he's kind of avoided some of the scrutiny that you get from other candidates. So I think that really in the past week people have started to appreciate it, but maybe it hasn't fully sunk in everybody's brains that Bernie winning this thing is really quite likely at this point. He has a clear path. I think that besides Biden, he has the clearest path. He wins. There's not a precedent for somebody winning Iowa and New Hampshire and then not becoming the nominee in either party. And, he's tied in Iowa in the latest polls. He's winning in New Hampshire. He won New Hampshire last time. I think that while he does certainly have a ceiling in the sense that there are certain parts of the Democratic electorate that won't vote for him, he has a lot of room to grow. And right now he has no support among Black voters, and I don't think that there's any reason to believe that they're completely allergic to Bernie and that he can't grow his vote share there somewhat. My basic message here is that I'm feeling a lot of familiar feelings about a candidate who is supposedly, going to flame out in the end and have the bottom fall out, but actually ends up becoming, the nominee and the president. And I think that that path is very clear right now for Bernie.
So Rick Wilson thinks that Bernie Sanders loses 40 states. Are you that pessimistic?
I'm not. Is pessimistic the word? I mean, I guess yes. I'm that.
As soon as I said that, I thought that's not the right word. Yeah, that's not the word I wanted to use.
Yeah, it's like I'm pessimistic about the state of affairs. When our pessimistic
that it would be
socialism.
Donald Trump winning 40 of 50 states for re-election.
Yeah, that'd be pretty disheartening for sure. No, I'm not there with Rick. I mean, I think that Bernie has a very narrow but plausible victory path through the Midwest. I think that the Bernie map is totally different. I think that Florida is gone, North Carolina is gone, Arizona is probably gone for the Democrats. I think that he's stronger really in Wisconsin than some of the other candidates out there. And you saw this New York Times poll. I mean, he from Nate Cohn maybe about a month or two ago now that showed Biden winning those Midwestern states narrowly. Bernie was losing, but close, and Warren was losing pretty decidedly. So I think that he has a narrow path through. I don't think it would be one of these things where, Bernie loses Rhode Island or something, some traditionally surprising blue state. I think that we're too polarized for that. But it certainly is not a winning ticket. It certainly doesn't seem like the best bet for Democrats who are looking for many paths, many chances to success. Having one narrow inside straight to draw.
So speaking of game-changing political developments, of course, we haven't even gotten to the announcement from John McAfee that he's running for president.
I'm concerned about the third. I mean, this is another thing that Bernie, a third party situation is really, probably helpful to Trump. McAfee being the exception, he kind of has a Trumpian flair, So I think he's just two standard deviations too insane to make it happen. I mean, he's even out there on the Trumpian scale. If you're looking at somebody and you say, man, I actually think Trump might have his screws together a little more than that guy, that is not a compliment.
Yeah, no. Cory Booker, how long is he going to last?
I think he's out. I've been waiting for Booker. You know, I've been kind of making the rounds.
Yeah,
with some
I think
of
he's
my,
out too. He's just not. You know.
Yeah, I don't understand it. You know, this is. You know, I moved to Oakland, right? So I'm around a lot of Democrats. You know, I've been banished from all of the parties that John Bolton is about to be banished from if he testifies against the president. So I don't. You know, I have a Democratic social. A group that lets me feel like I somewhat have a finger on the pulse of what's happening over there. But Corey has been one that I don't get. You know, he seems like a very safe bet compared to the other four. You know, he's not 78. He's not a mayor of a small town. You know, he has a pretty Obama-like platform, you know, left what used to be middle of the Democratic Party. Now I guess we're calling it center left. But, you know, and he has a clear path to victory, you know, using the Obama coalition. So I don't get it. I would think that a party that really wants to desperately defeat Donald Trump, I wrote something about this for The Bulwark, that you know, everybody says that Donald Trump's a crisis, but like nobody on the left really seems to be acting like it in their political choices. And it's just like the idea of putting up Bernie or, you know, at a time, you know, if this was a real crisis and you're like, the nation might not survive another 4 years, which is what a lot of Democrats say that they believe about Trump. Like, if that was what you believed, wouldn't you just be, you know, kind of coalescing around a nice, safe candidate that seems likely to win? But you're not seeing that. And it seems like Corey could have kind of filled that void, but there's just, he gets zero traction. So I think at this point it's too late. We're too close to Iowa and it's hard to see a path for him.
All right, so let's do some random.
I'm ready.
Non-political hot takes.
All right.
I just random. I don't get the Dallas Cowboys hiring Mike McCarthy. I mean, I just don't see it. I don't see Mike McCarthy getting along with Jerry Jones.
Well, if you want to win a Super Bowl, Mike McCarthy is the person that you want to hire, right? I don't know. It was a strange fit for me. They had a sleepover, I guess, I saw. I didn't get the details on that, but I just thought that was a fun. Nice. That's a fun tweet that Jerry Jones and Mike McCarthy had a sleepover.
Okay,
your turn. Hiring.
You can have another random non-political hot take.
Okay, well, I mean, obviously, I've got to go to the Tigers. I'm going to be traveling on Saturday down to New Orleans with my friends, the second string tailgaters, to root on LSU. The first, me and my college buddies first went to the LSU title game in 2004 in New Orleans, and so I've been looking at old pictures of myself then, and I looked very, very prepubescent at the time. It was kind of alarming. And so, you know, we're all going to get together a little bit gray in a week. And so I've got the spread's 5.5. Charlie, where are you landing? Are you going to take the Tigers?
I like LSU. I do. And that's going to be a lot of fun.
We're going to have a blast. It's going to be, and you know, I mean, they just absolutely annihilated Oklahoma, like almost enough to make you feel bad for them. I mean, it was painful.
They need to bring back the mercy rule.
Yeah, I couldn't even shit talk my Oklahoma alumni friends.
So I need something like that to look forward to, because that sounds like really fun. I mean, you're going to be totally jazzed about it, and you know, it's going to be a good time.
You can come. We've got a tailgate on the corner of Poydras and Magazine. Yeah, anybody, listeners, can come find me. You can come on down. Why not?
That does sound fun. I have to actually do a roast in D.C. I've never done one.
Who are you roasting?
You know, and you have to come. And this is a group that I don't know, you know, what their sense of humor is.
Okay. Are you getting roasted or are you roasting?
I'm roasting somebody.
Do you want to workshop anything?
Well, you know, I don't want to drop anything except that this here in the lineup. Yeah. This is what I'm haunted by.
Okay.
In the lineup, I come up after Madeleine Albright.
That seems like a great spot.
I'm really afraid that she might be funnier than me. I don't want her to be funnier than me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think it's a good spot in the lineup because she'll be graded on a curve, you know, so she is going to get laughs.
But I won't be. No.
You're not going to be, but it's going to be, I think, a low bar to pass. And Madeleine Albright cannot be that funny, can she?
Who's after you? Oh boy, I don't know. I was looking at it, and I'm very much on the lineup of like, why am I there? You know, what's wrong with this picture?
Got it. Well, you know, I'm happy to look through.
I think it's like Walter Isaacson.
I'm happy to workshop some jokes with you off air.
You're laughing at me now.
Walter Isaac. I mean, I'd be happy. You know, if you can't do it, I guess I'll be in Louisiana, but I'd feel pretty confident being sandwiched between, that sounds gross, Madeleine Albright and Walter Isaacson in a roast situation. I think that sounds very, very doable. I don't think you need to have any concerns about that whatsoever.
Is pot legal in D.C.?
I think it's decriminalized.
Yeah, I just don't know. And I had no idea why I asked that. That was completely unrelated to anything else that we were talking about.
I don't think that you should get high before the roast, if that's what you're asking. Maybe after as a decompression, but I don't think it's going to. If you have some nerves about following Madeleine Albright, I don't think taking some gummies is going to really do the trick for you.
It doesn't actually make you funnier, but you might laugh more at your own jokes.
That's true.
Okay,
I'm going to advise against that as your unofficial roast consultant.
Should just stop right here. So if you have a book of like good roast jokes that Jeb didn't use, if you could just email me,
I'm happy to. I do have a friend who is a roast joke writer. I don't want to out him on the show. So I'm happy to connect you if you're in an emergency.
That's a thing. Tim Miller, thank you so much for coming in and doing the first ever Bulwark podcast from the new Bulwark offices. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie. Go Tigers.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.